All right, folks, we are back. Flagstick.com T-Top Podcast brought to you this week by TaylorMade and the all-new Sim Fairway. Sitting down with my usual co-host, Scott McLeod. How are you today?
I'm doing okay. Yourself?
I'm all right. The weather is just, you know, I'm going to take the weather as a positive. The weather in Ontario is bad at best. I'm going to call it bad. It's just kind of cold and windy and the sun comes up a little bit. And I feel like the golf gods are looking over us in Ontario. And they're like, you know what? You have to stay inside. You can't golf. So here's just crap weather. So you don't even have to think about the idea of even potentially playing golf. Is this a good way to look at it?
Yeah, you might as well. I mean, I think the hard part of it is the fact that so many golf courses we're seeing are, you know, they're in great shape. That's the cool part, that we didn't have a lot of bad weather early on. It's just kind of cooling off now. So a lot of golf courses are green, you know, staff is there maintaining them. They're getting in good shape. So you know what, when we're ready, when the weather's ready, when it's allowable, we'll be able to get out there and play as much as we want.
I hope they're punching the greens now and doing all that type of stuff that you'd have to deal with, you know, nothing worse than you get to a course, you're ready to play, and you get there and the greens are punched. I hope they're doing all that type of stuff now. I know there's the proper time based on temperatures and blah, 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 blah. That doesn't make sense to me, but, you know, the superintendents love that, those conversations, but I hope once they're ready, they do them as early as possible. So when the golf courses do open up, we don't have to deal with that.
Well, I think most superintendents will agree the best golf courses for them from a working environment are the ones with no golfers on them, where they can get a golf course in perfect shape, you know, fix ball marks, take care of lots of little things. Yes, granted, they probably have minimal staff on for some of these places, but certainly they're going to be in pristine condition. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the ability for them to be able to do certain maintenance practices, things they have to do, is just going to make them that much better, that much stronger when they're ready to go.
Well, that means the courses that are proposed to be on the new PGA Tour schedule should be in mint condition when they show up, as the PGA Tour did announce their new schedule coming out for mid-June. I'm drawing a blank on the first event right now. I do apologize. Scott's going to tell us, obviously.
Yeah, it's going to be the Charles Schwab, which is a Colonial, which Michael Toth, who's actually a Canadian, is the tournament director down there. And, you know, that's the proposed start for the year. That is the schedule that they put out. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of factors that go in it. You know, as much as they can pin this down, it's fluid. It's a fluid situation. So if we look at golf courses that are available in the U.S., you know, almost half the golf courses that can be open are open down in the U.S., you know, practicing, obviously, safe procedures in all the different places. How this is going to look, I don't know. I mean, they're talking about the first four events, not having spectators involved. That said, you know, as we've talked about before, it takes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people to run these operations. So, you know, it's a proposed schedule. Will it happen? That's the big thing. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that as far as, you know, will this really happen?
Yeah, the timing of this couldn't have come at a worse time when they announced this. Like, clearly, they don't know when we record this podcast, because last week, this would have been a great conversation to have with Corey and Kyle.
Yeah.
I got a couple things that the average listener may know, may not know. Thing number one, not all the PGA Tour players fly private.
Yeah.
I don't know where you're going to get an airplane places, let alone safely places. So that's one thing to note. How you're going to get all those players out there? How are you going to get the guy that, you know, last year just made it into the PGA Tour, has very limited status on the PGA Tour, doesn't have much money in the bank? How are you going to get him from event to event safely? Is he renting an RV with his caddy, and those are the only two people that they have to now, two people that have to spend so much time together already, now have to travel everywhere together just to keep things safe? Because when you're with a caddy, you got to whisper, you got to be real close to each other to make decisions. You really can't, like, that whole logistic is,
yeah,
baffling me. But really, the travel's one where I just don't know how they're doing it, unless literally there's private charters for each event with the volunteers from each event going from event to event, only those folks with the caddies. They're tested every single day, I guess, which is the optics of that. I hate to break it to everyone, yeah, that wants it. That's going to look awful. I read something about 1 million tests or something like that, when we can't even test the general public just to bring a sport event. I get the economy is important and things like this, and this is a big part. Sports are a big part of, you know, the economy, but it just, the optics look real bad to rush it back. And that's where I'm wondering, will it happen? If you gave me a percentage, a Scotty's percentage to put on it, I'm giving this like 25%. I think unless something drastic happens, and there has been some positive news in places, but I just don't see how you do it. I don't know. That's my percentage. 25% to see that event.
I think that's the hard part, is the logistics of it. It's really easy as someone who wants to be an advocate for the sport, who wants to play the sport, to sit there and go, you know what? It can be safe to go out and play, which is fine. It's easy to say that. The issue that comes is when you start to break down all the logistics that go, and all the things that you don't even imagine. I mean, talking to a couple of course operators, and they're obviously trying to come up with a game plan for what they're going to do going ahead. And, you know, they're scrambling to get, you know, enough cleaning supplies on a commercial basis, enough wash stations. There's a lot of different things that are really important here. And then on the other side of it, they're going, okay, should I be the one seeking cleaning supplies for my business, even though I'm trying to get open and obviously take care of my employees, or should those cleaning supplies be going to a medical facility? I mean, so that's the hard part here. So when it comes down to looking at large sporting events for the PGA Tour, I know the PGA Tour does a lot for charity. What's nice is that a whole bunch of events have come forward and said, you know, our charitable efforts are still going to continue. We're still going to try to give money back to our community, even if our event doesn't run. But yeah, from an optic standpoint, that's certainly one thing. And then from a logistics standpoint, that's a whole other thing. And I certainly wouldn't want to be the one planning to do that.
It's tough to do. Makes a commissioner's job difficult, that's for sure. One event that didn't make the cut, unfortunately, was the Canadian Open, which we are a Canadian podcast. We've talked in length about last year's Canadian Open being one of our favorite Canadian Opens, one of the best Canadian Opens of all time, and in many ways, coming off such a high to now have to wait 2 years to get back. I felt they had so much good momentum going in this year, probably would have had the strongest field we have seen in a long, long time. And I hope it can carry over till next year. Losing St. George's as well is tough, just such an iconic track. What were your first thoughts? And do you think that we're going to be able to carry over that momentum?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there were so many stories to come out of it that, you know, they'll do their best to kind of mine that of what happened at Ancaster. And, you know, but it's going to be in 2021. Fortunately, St. George's will be the host in 2021, so they're going to be able to do that. But yeah, it does create some difficulty. But again, it's all relative to everything that we talk about, you know, as far as relative of importance. You know, for Golf Canada, yes, a definite disappointment. For RBC as well, RBC will still have the Heritage, the other event that they sponsor in the PGA Tour. You know, the RBC Canadian Open, you know, it's operated since 1904, and there's only been twice in its history, seven times total, but during the First World War and during the Second World War, that it hasn't been operated. So, you know what, it was probably a wise decision, because they looked at so many things. Again, from a logistics standpoint, you know, our borders closed right now, technically, you know, I mean, getting people in there, crowds, there's two concerts that were planned to happen at Richview Collegiate just down the road. A lot of different moving parts. Of course, in Toronto, they would need permitting as well for the Islington, for the avenue there, to basically close that down, to be able to get players down to the practice facility, the Islington Golf Club. So many things here that, you know, it just turned out to be sort of maybe just the wisest decision they possibly could. Disappointing for Canadian golf fans, obviously, for many, many reasons. Disappointing for, you know, players that maybe had exemptions into it, had maybe, you know, qualified certain ways for the PGA of Canada. But, you know, it's just the reality of it. And, you know, we'll just now, as they said, they're going to focus on 2021 and do the best they can to put on the best performance, the best event possible in 2021.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm glad it's back there. That's a course that we need to see on the PGA Tour again, that's for sure. The Mackenzie Tour also announced that they are moving down to six events, the first event being in July at the Windsor, in Windsor, the Windsor Championship, the Ambassador Golf Club. This is one where I felt the most for the players. This is a getting on the Mackenzie Tour is extremely hard. That Q school process is not fun, just like any Q school process. And these are guys that, you know, they're going to lose money even if they win on the McKenzie Tour, probably, like, I think you need to win a couple times a year to actually make money. And now they literally have nowhere really to play unless they're probably playing in some of those outlaw tour events. And this is one that stung. I thought of all those new pros, those kids coming out of college, that this was, they were going to get some events this year. There's obviously a couple friends of ours and a couple students of yours that were probably going to be part of this, and having that limited in that first year of being a pro is it's hard to not even think about those long-term effects that this could actually have. That first year being a pro, especially at age, like you're losing a age that's so important to your mm-hmm. development as a pro. You know, yes, you're only 1 year older, but in that young age, 1 year is a huge development time. And now, instead of being 23 or 22 as a pro, you're 24, 25 in that first year. That it seems small, but it is a big deal.
Yeah, this is the start of the ladder for them as they work their way up on the PGA Tour circuit. I mean, trying to get their way from McKenzie Tour up to Korn Ferry Tour up to the PGA Tour, I mean, this is where they start. This is where they get their true experience to get off the, you know, the mini tours, get to a tour that's organized so that it's going from week to week. They have status within the PGA Tour family. There's a lot of things that happen here. So yeah, for them to all of a sudden lose half their schedule, they're going to make some announcements in the next few weeks of what's going to happen with the Q school. So we'll see how those arrangements are made. But you know, being down to six events, I mean, it's hard enough as it is when you get on a tour. You know, and again, you know, a McKenzie Tour, I guess, was going to have 13 events this year, but you know, that's a small window to perform really well. And that puts a lot of pressure on you. And you think about that, if someone says to you, you know, you have to play well in the next three events. I mean, that's hard. That's really hard to do. And you need that time to grow and blossom as a player. So all of a sudden, if that season is compressed in six, you know, events, and your whole season is based on that.
Also, it's six events that are widely separated too.
Yeah.
That's the thing, right? With the McKenzie Tour, it usually starts and you have a little bit of a gap and you're traveling in one direction a little bit, and you're able to maybe get some money and save some money. Maybe you make a couple cuts and you're able to cover costs, right?
Right.
If we start in Windsor in July, the next event is in Calgary, and then you go to Winnipeg, right? And then you go to Manitoba. Those aren't close. Those, like, no. Canada is massive. These are not close places. Like, you're flying from Windsor to Calgary, and you're flying from Calgary to Winnipeg. And when you're on the McKenzie Tour, that's a lot of money. So the fact that they didn't have the rest of the year to even spend that money, maybe they are saving money. Maybe some of these guys are able to work and save money and prepare for that, but still, it's something to think about. I mean, a depressing start to the podcast. I'm not even going to lie. We're off to a rough start.
Here's the thing for this as well. I mean, they said there's going to be some more announcements. They're going to talk a little bit more about more tour events. Where there's still a possibility, you know, they're talking about, obviously, you know, Q school changes for that. There's still a possibility that they may add some other events in some way. The issue, of course, is that, you know, we start to be restricted as far as dates, schedule, weather. It is Canada. But it is quite possible that we might hear some adjusted dates for some other events as well. But, you know, hopefully for those players that were planning to play that tour, they get the most out of it this year, that the, you know, the charities can still benefit from what the PGA Tour Canada, McKenzie Tour does for them, and that there will be some positives in the end by the end of the year.
Yeah, I like it. Let's turn to positives for a second, because
we're
not going to go to the interview yet, but we have a great guest this week. And if you're a hockey fan, you know this face, you know this voice. James Duthie of the TSN panel is our host of the TSN panel. You've probably seen him when he's at the Masters, if you're watching on TSN. Golf nut, to say the least. Going to talk about all the different tools he's bought over the years and his time at Augusta. We'll get to it. It's a fun interview. We got positive stuff to talk about. So I just want to make sure you stick around for that. No, the rest of this podcast isn't just going to be about all the bad stuff that's happening out there in the world of golf and the postponements. And we're also going to talk about another tournament we watched recently, but there's a couple other news notes we want to talk about. Big conversation on Twitter about the Ryder Cup and potentially playing without spectators. A lot of hot takes on whether you agree this should happen or shouldn't happen based on spectators. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the fact that, you know, they're going to, you know, they're talking about obviously going forward, it's going to be in the schedule, but whether it has spectators or not, I don't really care. I understand that spectators are important as far as the cheering and the momentum and the feel of the environment. And so for the people, whether you hate me over this one or not, for the people saying that you can't have the Ryder Cup without spectators, sure you can. It may not be the same energy, but you know, you're still going to be able to watch it. The players are still going to be there. They're still going to be able to compete. Yes, it's going to be memorable for maybe different reasons, and we don't have those people cheering at the first tee or, you know, back and forth, and we don't see players playing it up to the crowd, whether it's, you know, McIlroy or Reed or whatever the case may be. But, you know, it's just what it is. It is what it is. And I mean, really, I would rather have that than nothing.
I agree. If you think the Ryder Cup needs it, then you also think hockey needs it and football and all those need spectators. And if that's your take, then don't hold your breath because sports won't be coming back for a long time if that's the case by the sounds of it. I actually agree with you. You know, if we look at it from a need of spectators, the 16th hole at TPC Scottsdale needs spectators. If not, it's just a crappy par three. The Ryder Cup would still be a very competitive thing that you will enjoy watching without spectators. I promise you that. I know the intensity on Sunday of the Ryder Cup with those spectators gets, you know, it just makes the tournament exactly what it is. Sure. But, you know, the Friday, Saturday with or without spectators, other than the first hole, you're really not going to notice a big difference. I promise you that. But I understand your take. Yes, spectators change momentum. That changes the way players feel, right? You go to the first tee of the Ryder Cup with no one there on the first tee, you're still going to have nerves. You go to the Ryder Cup with 10,000 people on the first tee, now you got a lot of nerves. So I get what the argument people are making, but I would definitely be watching it. It'll still be a great tournament. I won't put an asterisk beside it by any means.
No, that's for sure. I mean, I'll be watching if it happens. And then you got to remember too, the way it is on the schedule right now, it'll feed into the US Open the next week. So there's a lot of storylines that will play out there as well.
Absolutely.
All right. A couple other things happening this week. I mean, I noticed we had our third admission to the World Golf Hall of Fame this year. We've talked about it earlier on the show. Tiger was the easy one for him to go in. Marion Hollins went in, obviously well-known as an amateur player that, you know, she was behind Paso Tiempo, a bunch of other iconic golf courses. But the third one that was announced this week was interesting, especially from the reaction of the people. So it was Tim Finchem, who was obviously a former commissioner of the PGA Tour, but some people are critical going, okay, is this guy in here just because it was, you know, he was commissioner during the iconic period of, you know, fees going up and purses going up, and, or was he just there and just happened to be there when Tiger Woods came along and you could sign these great TV deals, and really, you know, he's riding along on Tiger's coattail. And, you know, administrators play a large part of the game. But whether they need to be a Golf Hall of Fame member or not at a world level, that's an interesting take. As one person said, it's not meant to be an employee of the month level.
Yeah, and that's how I took it. If I'm Tim, my speech goes like this. Thank you, Tiger Woods. And then I walk off.
Drop the mic and away you go.
That's the only reason he's going in the Hall of Fame is because Tiger Woods showed up. He made golf exciting, that a lot of people started watching it in that way. Now, and that's not to say golf wasn't exciting. It was, let's say it was a niche sport before. I know that's unfair, but you just take it that way for the sake of my argument. Tiger Woods shows up. The purses go up because Tiger's bringing more viewers in. So people are sponsoring. It's not called, because Tim, like if Tiger didn't show up, Tim Finchem wouldn't be like the best golfer of all time that changed everything. It was Tiger that changed everything. He just was able to ride the coattails. I 100% agree with that take. I truly believe, though, here's the problem. I think Hall of Fames in general, we have issues with, in the fact that I've already talked about this, but we feel we need to put somebody in every single year, but you don't need to put somebody in every single year. And that's how you dampen the product. I actually was doing a little bit of research, and they used to have actual, you know, set guidelines on the PGA Tour for the men's side of things for the Hall of Fame. And they had to loosen those up because they realized 19 wins in the post 1975 era was really hard to do. Exactly. The Hall of Fame should be hard to get into, right? Like
it's not the Hall of Good.
Yeah, exactly. It made no sense. I was reading that take. I was like, what? That, wait, what? Like, it just seems very, you know, we joke about, you know, they say these millennials, everyone wants a participation trophy. That's how this feels to me, is a participation trophy now, the Hall of Fame. It's not as you know, elite as it once was and as it should be. And I joked about it earlier, but this year really should be one person going in. It should be Tiger Woods, and that's it. Because the other two names, nobody really cares about right now. No disrespect to the other two we have mentioned. They have done a lot for golf. But Tiger Woods is the reason that Tim is going in. Any stretch, any reason. No, you can't fight me on this one. I'm not going to agree with you.
Yeah, there's, you know what? Here's the thing. There's a lot of ways to recognize the efforts of people at various levels. There really is. I mean, there's a lot of ways to give respect to the contributions of people, whether they are athletes, administrators, whatever the case may be. But if you're talking about the pinnacle of a sport, an activity or anything, it's got to remain very tight. And, you know, I'll give credit to the LPGA. They have had one of the tightest, you know, basically regulations around their tour of getting in their Hall of Fame. I mean, it's very difficult to get into that Hall of Fame. I mean, you have to win a lot. You have to do a lot. So as you said, it needs to be more about, you know, the best of the best, and, you know, where Tim Finchem falls in that. You know what? Honor him, give him a plaque, throw him a brick, but I don't know if he needs to be up there with Tiger Woods.
You know who I'd rather in the Hall of Fame than Tim Finchem?
Who's that?
James Duthie.
Yeah.
That's who I'd rather in the Hall of Fame. I think it's a great time to head over to our interview with James Duthie, talk about everything golf. This guy loves golf. We could have had him for 2 hours if we wanted to. That's how much James loves golf. So without further ado, James Duthie.
This episode of Tee Talk is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new Sim Fairway. After months of obsessive testing and tinkering, the TaylorMade engineers cracked the code with a newly redesigned V-Steel sole, which allowed them to take the center of gravity lower than any fairway they've ever created. The result is a huge benefit whether you're an amateur or a top 10 world-ranked player. It's now much easier to get high launch from anywhere on the course. The all-new Sim and Sim Max fairways, they took CG lower to take you higher. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family. Okay, we want to welcome to the podcast, best known as the broadcast quarterback for TSN's hockey coverage, but also a massive golf fan and a contributor to TSN's golf coverage, James Duthie. James, welcome to the show.
Steph and Scott, thanks for having me.
You know, obviously, you know, it's a different time right now, and, you know, golf season is pretty much, well, hopefully upon us at some point, but we've had some recent setbacks, you know, understandably. One of those things was the postponement of the Augusta National, the Masters, and, you know, you're part of that broadcast, and what did that mean to you to have that postponed?
It hurt deeply. And look, again, you know, everything we say on this podcast is with perspective of that it's nothing compared to, you know, those suffering with the virus. Or, but look, I think still you're still allowed to be a golf fan. You're still allowed to care about an event like that. And it was always my favorite event of the year. Actually, I don't know about my favorite event. I love the World Juniors, but it's my favorite week of the year for the same reason it is for you guys, because the Masters always symbolizes the real start of the golf season, not just on tour, but for all of us that, you know, spring's around the corner and we'll all be golfing soon. And for me, I guess I've done it maybe 7 years. I did it my first one back in 2002, and then I went a long time without doing it again because of hockey playoffs. And then after the whole rights situation where we lost the national rights and we weren't doing playoff games, I was able to get the Masters back on my docket. And so I think I've done six since then. But just being there on those grounds and when the weather's nice and it's just so perfect, it really is my favorite time of the year. And so that week, thank goodness we ran all the Masters rewinds on TSN, so at least you could watch. And those were actually pretty enjoyable. I know I sound like I'm plugging the network, but it was fun to watch those again. But it really hurt missing it.
Yeah, we've been breaking down the Masters, you know, going back to, we did one from the 70s, we did one from the 80s. We've done them all over the last couple weeks, and it was great that TSN was broadcasting those as well. But talking about the Masters, you're one of a few guests we've had on this podcast actually have been able to play the course. I know it was a few years ago. I'm sure you still have dreams about it. What was that experience like? And first question I also need to know, did you cry at any point? Because I feel like I would be crying at some point out there on the course.
I don't think I did. I think I probably almost cried when I put my, I laid up on 15 and then put my third shot in the water. I almost cried then, but not for the same reason that you're talking about. It was amazing. The one thing I always... You know, when I was a kid, first of all, my bucket list was to go to Augusta. From the age of whenever I started watching the Masters, 8 or 9 years old, and I just loved it. And I never thought I could ever go. I really said, how do you ever, I'm never going to get there, a little kid growing up in suburban Ottawa. So to actually, when I actually got to play it, like that wasn't even on my dream bucket list, right? And so when it happened and they come in on the Sunday morning. I don't know how much you've gotten into. Have you ever had any other guests tell you about the whole, how it works and how you get drawn?
We're aware of how it works. Scott's been in the media, but we haven't had any guests been drawn. The only other guests we've had are actually played in the Masters, which is a whole other flex that they have on us.
So bottom line was I felt I had, it's supposed to be a random draw, but I'm not sure it's quite 100% random. I always feel like there's a little bit of finagling going on behind the scenes somehow. And I was the only guy, if you do win, you can't play again for 7 years. And so I was the only guy at TSN on our crew, besides maybe one of the camera operators who had never played before. So I thought I had a decent chance because it felt like every maybe 2 years, somebody from TSN would win and nobody had had the year before. So I felt like I had a shot and I brought in my clubs. But you don't know, and it's not till the Sunday morning of the final round that they actually tell you. And there's a guy named Lee who wears the green jacket, who kind of is in charge of media. And he walked into our office. We have a little office up there, the TSN. And as soon as he walked in, I knew, right? Because he doesn't really pay much attention to us during the week. So he said, James, how's your day going? Or how's your week been? And I knew right away. I was trying to play
coy. A lot better.
Yeah, and my heart jumped like I was 16 years old. It was crazy. And they give you this little invitation that says you must show up at a certain time. Come down at the top of Magnolia Lane. Be there at, I think mine said, 10:15 on the next morning, Monday morning. And so everybody else goes home. My crew leaves. And I took a cab. And I said, well, screw 10:15. I want to be there. I showed up at 9 and they turn you away. Like when they say 10:15, and Bob Weeks had warned me about this, you have to show up at literally 10:15. So I sat on the curb across the street from Magnolia Lane with my golf clubs for an hour and 15 minutes. And then at 10:13, I tried to walk up and he's like, nope, 2 more minutes. And then at 10:15, I finally got to walk up. And the other twist to it was you get to the range and there are all the caddies waiting for you on the range. You get to use the Champions Clubhouse, which was just unbelievable. The Champions locker room. And we got on the range and I thought I was going to have my tee off time was supposed to be 11:15 or something. So you had time for a full warm up. Well, I hit balls for 5 minutes and then I was going to the practice green. I was going to go back. I decided I'd go to the green for a while and then come back to the range. And I got to the green and they said, we got to go now. We're ahead of schedule. So I had no time to putt and I'd only warmed up for 5 minutes. And it's your first round of the year because it's April. You pulled your dusty clubs off the shelf. So that was my only regret is that I was not in fine form. Those were the days before I started going and playing indoor golf 3 times a week during the winter. So I wasn't in the best of form. I shot 92, which I was pretty proud of. Considering I was worried when I got to the first tee that I was going to shoot 120 or something because I hadn't hit all year and I was so nervous and so blown away by the golf course. And I could have I hit the ball really well, but I three putted like 13 times and made just some really stupid ass mistakes. But it was, golfers, they're always the Jack and Tiger can always remember every shot and they hit in every round, which I always find amazing. That's the only round of my life where I can remember every shot and every club that I hit. And I think I will be able to for the rest of my life.
So what did it feel like for an hour and 15 minutes on the side of the road on Washington Road, looking like some dreamer, you know, outside the gates? Everybody's probably driving by and going, you know, look at that loser with his golf clubs sitting outside the gate. But you knew the whole time that you were going to make that trip up Magnolia Lane.
Yeah, it was amazing. I actually forgot one part of the story. I got up in the morning, you know, I didn't sleep at all. So it was about 5 a.m. and I'm putting on the hardwood floor in this rental house that we had. I'm the last person to leave. And I suddenly looked in my bag and realized I had like two balls. And so I called the cab early, and the only place I could find open was a Walmart. And the only thing they had were like Top Flight XLs. So that's what I went with, which no offense to Top Flight. I think it was Top Flight Hot XLs.
So, oh, those are nice. Those are nice.
So that's what I showed up with at Augusta National. And so I'm like, how am I going to play friggin' Top Flight XLs? And the caddies are lined up behind you. And they have, you know, the practice balls are Pro Vs with Augusta National logos on them. And obviously I wanted those, period, just to, for a souvenir. But secondly, I needed the balls. So I said to the caddy, I said, are we allowed to, you know, take any of those? And he's like, no. And then he turned around and faced the other way, which was a signal to me. So I just took like 8 of them and stuffed them in my bag. And that's what I played with, which is a complete embarrassment as a golfer to play with Augusta range balls at Augusta. But that's what I did. And I have no regrets.
Besides the one you dumped in the pond then on 15, how many did you end up surviving with?
Well, that was the only ball I actually lost that day. So that's why I was trying to, seeing that my score wasn't going to be great and I putted lousy and just made some horrible mistakes. I said to myself that if I could play the round with one golf ball, that would be pretty cool. And then I dunked it. And I had a chance to go for it on 15 too, but I kind of wussed out. And I actually did drop a ball and hit a second with a 3-wood, which I hit really good and slammed into the empty bleachers behind 15, which is like 25 yards past the green. So I hit it really well, but it went nowhere near. I did that just for kicks. But anyway, no, it was just, man, it was, I can remember I could tell you every single shot right now. And it's the one thing that everybody warned me, I think Bob Weeks warned me, and it was true, is that it's the quickest round of your life because you don't want it to end. And it felt like it took an hour and 45 minutes and it was over.
So of all those shots that you remember, what one do you think, you know, as age takes over and each shot blurs away, what's the one that's going to hang on right until the end?
Well, it's not that it was a fantastic shot, but I think that the tee shot on 12 was probably the most, in to me, is the most iconic shot there. And I think it was playing maybe 156 or something, whatever. Same that it plays for the guys. I should tell people they don't know. You don't play the Masters tees, you play the club tees. I know you've had guests on. And so back in 97 or 98, they were essentially the same as the pro tees. But now that they've made so many changes, there's certain holes where they're close. Certain holes like 11, for instance, where it's about 120, 30 yards back. But I think on 12, it's the same tee. So whatever it was, 156. And there was a little bit of a breeze and I was between 7 and 8, I think. And he told me to go with the one longer, to go with the 7. And I put it into the back bunker. I just rolled it like it was literally only 6 inches into the back bunker. So that was one time I yelled at my caddy. I'm like, told you it was an 8.
Did he grab all the balls and then throw them in the water?
That's right.
Oh, like, I don't have any balls anymore. Yeah.
Don't talk to me anymore. No. So that was but I remembered that because that, the year that I played was the year that Spieth put 2 in the water on 12. And we actually went back and I took a couple of photos by his divots. And so I was happy. I made 4. And so I was happy. I think that's the one that'll probably stick out in my mind. That was the one other thing that I guess I look back and regret if I had one more chance. I didn't make any birdies. I didn't make any. The only other thing was be on 1 where I, besides 12, probably the most nervous I was on 1. I hit a 3-wood in the fairway, but I hit it like 215 or something, kind of popped it up. And then I hit it to the right side of the green and the pin was right. So it's a really tough up and down and I got up and down, made about a 6-footer for par. So that's probably the other thing that I'll really remember, because, okay, I parred one at Augusta, and I think I only made three other pars the rest of the day, four other pars the rest of the day.
Well, it's safe to say you are a golf nut. You recently on your podcast were talking about this net that you had set up, right? And the amount of money that you somehow got sold on to set up this net. Why don't you tell us about what happened, though, once you actually got the net set up, and has your wife found out yet?
She has found out. She found out the other day. So essentially, I had to negotiate. We do have some room in our backyard. I live on a decent-sized lot up in Aurora, north of Toronto. And so the only negotiation was she didn't want it to be an eyesore. So she didn't want me to set it up. You know, our family room looks out onto the backyard. She didn't want this net right in front of it. So we sort of have this secondary little balcony back off the garage. And I made a deal that I would put it there. And it actually just fit in. It was like the perfect size. And I can swing there. But there is a nice, you know, one of these restoration hardware outdoor lamps that was there. And so I noticed, okay, this is going to be the only problem. And when I went to driver, it was really close. So I for about a week, I just hit irons. And I said, I really like to hit a driver. So I pulled my driver out and I took about 8 practice swings, and each time it was close, but I was clear by about 3 inches. So I took my very first real swing and smashed the lamp. Glass everywhere. So I hid it from her. But then she was out in the backyard the other day, and my daughter was fooling around with me with the net, and she said, "Dad, what happened to the lamp?" And I'm like, oh, why did you have to say that? But anyway, so yeah, but it's, you know, it is nice, although I you guys, I'm sure, have the same experience. Like, golfing into a net sits old. I don't have any sort of, the next thing I got to get is a sky tracker or something. I got to know that at least give me a distance or something out of these balls, particularly if this thing goes on for, you know, if we're still off the courses in another month or month and a half, I have to have something like that.
Are you going to go full Jerry D, get a full sim in the house, or no?
So the my greatest regret in life might be a stretch, because I've had a few, but in we renoed our base. We had a basement which had pretty high ceilings, and we only finished it 2 years ago. And we ended up just putting in like a theater and a bar or whatever. And I don't know. I think that was before. I've always loved golf. Golf became a complete obsession, I would say, in the last 4 years. Maybe it was 4 years ago we did that reno. And I just didn't think about the sim. I hadn't thought that was a realistic thing for me. And now I just go down there every day and say, why didn't I put a sim in? Because I look at things like Jerry's and other people, and I would die to have that now.
Yeah, we had Gary Galley on the podcast, and I work with his son, and he told me that Gary's building a new house, and he has plans for a simulator within the new house.
Every hockey player, every guy that has the money should definitely do it if you have the means. And I said that's a regret that'll haunt me for a long time. I'm still thinking about if I get the sky tracker, I've started to measure my garage, so I could, again, there's a bit of a overhang issue with the, you know, the garage opener, but I'm thinking I could at least have that in there for the winter.
That could work. So you know, you have the net set up. You're hitting balls and everything. Now, O-Dog constantly chirps you. Jeff O'Neill chirps you, saying you have all these training aids. And anything, you're basically the guy on Golf Channel. When those ads come out, you're buying it. Is this true? And if so, what's the worst one that you purchased?
So there's truth in what he says. Here's my problem with O. Okay, O's a really good golfer, first of all. One of the best golfers I've ever played with, as far as just natural ability. Never warms up. Shows up to the course with a butt hanging out of his mouth like 2 minutes before the tee time.
Perfect.
And never walks, like carts everywhere. But he's really talented.
Does he have the flag that can pull it right up beside the green?
No, he doesn't have that, but he'd get it if he could. But he's just, you know, it's the same way he played hockey. Like, O was just a naturally gifted athlete who has unbelievable hands. And I've only played 2 rounds with him in my life, and they were both at his course at Weston. And the first was with him and Mike Zigomanis, another ex-NHLer. And that was, he got his first hole-in-one that day, actually. And I was, I'll admit it, I was awful. Like, they were playing off the backs, like the Blacks, which was pretty long off Weston. And I get, you know, a little intimidated playing with guys who are really, really good. Like, I'm an 11. And I was awful that day. I probably shot, you know, 97 or something like that. But so O has his hole-in-one card. And as we're walking off the green, I'm like, oh, if you're going to publish your card like you do, like people do with the holes-in-ones, could you just clean me up a little, clean up mine a little bit, you know? Because I am a very honest golfer. I'll take my, you know, I'll take my eights, nines, even, you know, not for cap, but whatever. And so what does he do? This is the prankster that O is. Instead, so he puts his card up on Twitter. He says, I got my first hole-in-one. Here's my card. And he took, his is accurate. Zigomanis is accurate. And on my card, he's like, he writes like 12, 11, 13, 14, 12, 11. And he gives me one par on the number one handicap. But he, it had me shooting like 170. So I just got crucified on Twitter the next 4 days by people saying, are you the worst golfer in the history of the world? So I played two rounds with him. I've not played well. So, tell Carlo Koliakovo's my, who has played with Owen. I've beaten him twice and he knows I had two really good rounds with him. So he knows my true potential.
How often do you get out?
So I went, I was a typical guy who loved golf, had three kids in 4 years and was going out, you know, eight times a year. Once they, I would say I joined Clublink 4 years ago and I went from 10 rounds to like, you know, 30 and then 40. And then last year I probably played 70. That was probably the most I've ever played, played before. So a lot.
That's an understatement. It'd be nice to play that many. Do you work on your game though? I mean, you say you're 11.
But... I never did before. And yeah. You know, my problem, I never took lessons. I never grew up in a, my dad was not a golfer. I didn't grow up in a country club environment, like a lot of these guys did. And so I play, I was a hack who I lived in Ottawa and my friend and I, Mark Ward, we used to go when I was about 14, when we started golfing, we started with mini putt, like a lot of kids do. And then we had a golf course, Pineview Municipal Golf
Course. Of course, yep.
You guys know it.
Little road, yep.
And so I would walk to Mark's house with my little bag of about five clubs, and I would throw rocks at his window to wake him up. This is in the dark, basically, at 4:30 a.m. We would catch the first OC Transpo bus outside his house, and we would sit on the first tee at Pineview, watch and wait till the sun was up high enough, till the sun came up, so it was in basic darkness. Parents were a little different back then. They didn't care about your kids going out in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And this is what we do in the summer. And we had no money. So we would, our thought was that if we played nine holes before, if we got past, the clubhouse was, you know, at nine, like a lot of courses. And if you got past the clubhouse and down 10 before anybody showed up, that then we could, 18 didn't end at the clubhouse and ended near a bus stop. So we'd just walk off 18 and leave. And I think we knew we were breaking the law, but we kind of rationalized that, well, it's a public golf course, so public should be able to walk there. And if we're playing before hours, we're not doing anything. And so we did that probably 10 times a summer. We would just play and never pay at Pineview. So I owe Pineview about, I don't know, a couple thousand bucks probably. But I never – and then, you know, I didn't – so I never started working on my game until the last couple of years. I go to a place called Peak Performance in Vaughan, Ontario, which has, you know, great simulators and bays and putting green and the chipping green, and take lessons from a guy named Ryan who's excellent. And so I never understood the swing. I never really knew what was wrong with what I was doing. And this is the first – I've only really started to learn a lot in the last couple of years, which is sometimes the worst thing. And I do video myself a lot, and like during the playoffs, we'll be sitting there and watching the game, and every commercial and intermission, I'll just be watching my swing. And so Dave Poulin and Jeff O'Neill just laugh the hell out of me. This is a long-winded way of answering your question and saying, I haven't really bought many devices. I bought that little, what's that, you little yellow thing that attaches onto your club that keeps your wrist angle?
I know which one you're talking about.
Little plastic stick. Yeah. I haven't even used that yet because my pro told me it wasn't going to help me. I brought the little ball. Kevin Hayden, the pro in Ottawa, suggested that ball that you put between your arms, which
smart
I just
ball.
Found, actually. Cleaned out my garage yesterday. But my pro just lent me the swing
Swingmate? Or Plane Mate.
Plane Mate, the one with the bands?
Yeah, yeah.
So, which apparently is getting a lot of buzz, is a very helpful tool. So I have it sitting in the back of my car, and if the wind ever goes down today, once I get my work done, I might try that for the first time. So anyway, that was a very long-winded way of saying it's a lie that I have a ton of devices, but he's right that I do obsess over my game.
Now, what about the SX7 putter? If it cut off like one stroke off your game, the one that like stands straight up and you can align it and you get behind it, are you using that?
I couldn't embarrass myself that badly. And no offense to anyone who has it. And maybe when I'm like 70, I'll be like all over something like that, because it actually does make some kind of rational sense, but I just couldn't do it. I think my buddies would just rip me too hard.
It'd be worse than having the 170 on the card, right?
Well, you know, the one other thing I do have is that, remember the momentum? It's a club that like weighs a lot, and the grip, the supposed right grip that you're supposed to have is fitted into the top of the club.
Yep.
I could go to the garage if you want. It was like a practice aid or a warm-up aid. I do have that. It's, you know, I haven't used it in 10 years, but that was the first aid I ever bought.
The problem with that is the grip has to go on straight for everything else to work. And who's putting the grip on?
I know, exactly. So anyway, but I do love it. Like, my family makes fun of me because I don't really have many vices, right? And golf is, as much as I love all sports and all the sports I cover, golf is the one that I'm truly obsessed with.
So you mentioned a bunch of TSM personalities and you've played with a bunch of them. We're going to make you choose, if you had to play every single round for the rest of time with one of them, who would it be? And then the opposite, you like the last person you would pick to play every single round for the rest of your life.
Well, the last one's O.
Kind of guessed that, yeah.
Yeah, like that's in a heartbeat. The first person, a TSN... see, because I play with, I shouldn't say the other network's name, but I play a lot with Sean McKenzie and David Amber from Sportsnet. And Amber, I would say, would be my first choice because I win money off him all the time because he's the most horrible clutch golfer in the history of golf. But at TSN, now you see, I got to be careful to sound like a creep. Like, a lot of the ladies play. I've played with Lindsay Hamilton before. She's an awesome person to play with.
Yeah, we played behind Lindsay at Magna this summer. She was
in front. So I'd probably choose somebody like Lindsay, but then people would think I'm a creeper because I'm going to choose one of our lovely ladies like Lindsay or Natasha or someone. So any of them would be probably at the top of my list. Dave Poulin, I would say, would probably be my answer because he's just a nice guy. And I've played with him, you know, a handful of times. We always have a good time out there. He loves golf the same way I do. You know, Dregs is another guy. Bob McKenzie, I'm supposed to go to Cabot with this summer. But Bob doesn't love golf the way I do. Dregs would be too much of a chirper for me. So I'm going to go with Pooley.
You mentioned Cabot there. Are there particular golf courses that you've yet to play that you want to play? Obviously, you've played Augusta National already. But so, yeah. You know, your bucket list is probably one shorter than it was before.
The obvious ones would be Pebble and a lot of the ones overseas. I covered the 2004-05, which is the one that Jack's last opened, the Tiger one. Or I get my years mixed up.
I think it was five. Was that who's
teasing? 405 at St. Andrews.
Yeah.
Yeah, 05.
Yeah.
So I've been to St. Andrews, but have not played it. So all the classic ones I think that a lot of people want to play are all my bucket list ones. Yeah, I mean, I love the Augusta thing because it's the greatest. If you're ever having a conversation with someone that, you know, doesn't follow TSN as much or doesn't follow golf as much, my favorite thing in the world is to be like in a bar conversation with a bunch of guys and they say, "What's your favorite course you ever played?" And these guys are like, "Oh, yeah, Cabot or, you know, the National in Toronto. What about you?" And I go, "Augusta National." I love dropping that in. It's just so jerky.
I think that's a flex you can have forever, though. It's starting a good conversation from there, at least, right?
Yeah, it is.
We mentioned earlier your podcast, and I might be giving you the best compliment ever, or you might take it wrong way. I think the podcast is called Rubber Boots Podcast, and I'm going to say it's the Seinfeld of podcasts because it's a podcast literally about nothing. Uh-huh. What did you guys sell the listeners on this podcast? It's one of my favorite ones to listen to because you have no idea where these guys are going each week, but one of the segments that you do often is you literally call Jeff O'Neill and just annoy him.
He's just a grumpy guy in general, although he's a great guy if you get to know him, and he's got a massive heart, but he hates it when he calls me more. Like, I got a lot of guy friends. We don't call each other anymore, right? My text. But Jeff would like call me randomly once a day, and often it would be when we were taping the podcast. That's how the gag started. So he would just call, and I'd be like, Jeff, we're taping the podcast, and then he'd say something annoying. So then I started to call him back. I don't know how to sell this pod, and that's been my problem from the beginning, and I should have never called it the Rubber Boots Pod because nobody has any clue what it is, but I don't care. I never did it to, you know, gain millions of listeners and have, you know, tons of sponsors. I basically want to give a few bucks to the guys I work with and have some fun 1 hour a week. So I think your description is pretty much apt. It's four guys talking about whatever pops into their head. I try to give back behind the scenes stuff at TSN as much as I can. And my wife, Brooksy, is a main character who I talk about all the stuff that she does, like these golf net experiences. And we talk about what we're watching on TV and what we did over the last week. And it's completely ridiculous, but we do have a really good time, and I appreciate you bringing it up.
Who does the episode titles? Because that's one thing I always note as far as the episode titles for those shows. I mean, they're somewhat out there sometimes.
So the only reason this pod happens is because Christoph, who's one of the characters on our pod, there's four guys, but he's also the producer. And he is the most talented producer guy going. Like, if some of the drops he puts in and some of the things he does, I'm sure that you listen to, is some of the sound effects. And he's just a really brilliant guy. He does the titles every week too. He'll take something stupid that we say. And I just actually finished taping it before I came on with you guys. So it was dumb as usual.
Well, can't wait. One other thing to look forward to. You've been talking about writing your third book. Fourth book. I must have missed
a lot of
one
people forget. I wrote a book called a book about Brian Kilray, who Ottawa folks know. And so, but it was kind of his book, one of those by Brian Kilray with James Duffy. So you can, I mean, I wrote it, but it was Killer's words. So you're both right. Technically, it's my fourth book, but it's my third book.
So what's how's the writing going, and what's this book about?
So this is a book which is just completely hockey stories. I wrote too many books about myself, and I wanted to do a book that was just one of the great things about my job, guys. Probably the best thing is that you get to sit around countless hours watching hockey games with guys who have amazing stories, guys like O-Dog and Jamie McLennan and Pooley and Bob McKenzie and all the guests we've had over the years. You know, whenever a coach gets fired, they end up on our panel, guys like John Tortorella and a lot of ex-players as well. And I've gotten to know a lot of players in the game, covering the game for 20 years. And I've always said to myself, that's my favorite part of the job, is during commercial breaks or pregame shows when we're sitting around eating pizzas, these guys tell a lot of off-color, but you know, a lot of great stories. And even though there's a million hockey books out there, I don't know that there was one that just had, you know, a collection of stories from different people. So basically I just went to a ton of hockey people and said, tell me your favorite hockey story. And that's what this book is. Just a collection of, I think there's 50 chapters of Wayne Gretzky and Sidney Crosby and Connor McDavid, and then great storytellers, you know, Brett Hull, Kelly Chase, and a lot of the guys I work with, Jamie McLennan, O-Dog, just telling their favorite stories.
Can you give us an example of one of them to get the audience hyped for when it comes out?
Oh man. Let me try and pick my favorite. I won't pick my favorite.
I was going to say that's your big sell. You don't want to give your favorite away. Give them a taste.
So, Steven Stamkos, his dad comes down to a game and, basically ends up stealing Steve Yzerman's car, by mistake. Essentially him, you know, all the players park in the same parking lot, and Stamkos and Yzerman had both been given similar cars by a car dealership. A lot of car guys have car deals. And so basically the dad, Steven, was lingering after the game doing media or whatever. He just gives his parents this car every time they're in town, and the dad gets home, you know, to their little gated community in Tampa or whatever. And the remote control is not working for the garage. And he starts looking down at the car and looks around and sees some papers and realize that he stole the GM's car. And meanwhile, Steven's back at the rink, and Steve Eiserman's assistant is calling, going, I think your dad took the GM's car. And it's all funny now, but Steve was like, Stamkos was panicking, thinking, okay, this is how I'm going to get traded or whatever. So stories like that, I'll tell you one more that I love. And this is one of my favorite stories. Jamie McLennan, Noodles, who's one of our guys on the panel and a great radio guy, when he first got called up by St. John's, he drafted by the Islanders. Sorry, not St. John's, whatever the Islanders farm team was. He goes to St. John's, Newfoundland to play two games. They would play back-to-back games. So he skates out for his first game. He's a goalie. First game in the pros, and there is a mascot for the St. John's team is a puffin, a giant bird, and it's standing in the net. And Noodles doesn't know what to do. He's this rookie goalie, so he kind of goes up beside it and kind of stands there, and the puffin is putting like a curse on him, and this goes back and forth, and the crowd is loving it. And finally, he kind of nudges his way into the net, and the puffin finally moves. And so Jamie has this great game. It's like the first star, and he's all proud. And Billy Smith, the Islanders' legendary goalie, was the goaltending coach who'd flown in to watch Jamie play. So Jamie walks into the dressing room feeling all good about himself, and Billy Smith is sitting at his locker and says, can I see you outside? Jamie's all, oh, okay, I'm going to get praise from Billy Smith, a legend. Basically, Billy Smith says, Jamie's waiting to get praise, and Billy Smith says, that was a fucking embarrassment out there. You embarrassed yourself. You let a bird, a giant mascot bird, embarrass you in your net. Noodles is sitting here going, what? I just had like a really good game in my first pro game. And he's like, don't ever let that happen to you again. Next time that happens, you kill that bird. So when they played in Newfoundland, they would play games two at a time. So 2 days later, they're going to play again. And Noodles is praying that he doesn't get the call again because he doesn't want to go anywhere near this mascot. Sure enough, he gets the call again from the coach, Butch Goring. So he's terrified. He doesn't sleep the night before. Gives up 4 goals in the first period. Because all he can think about is this bird that's going to be there in the intermission. So he comes out, and he had to skate the length of the ice where the team comes out from the Zamboni area. And sure enough, there's the bird in the net doing his thing. And so Noodles makes a decision about the blue line that he's just going to go for. So he just skates as fast as he can and clotheslines the bird with his goalie stick and sends it flying into the corner. And the bird is like out on the ice. Trainers have to help it off the ice. Noodles ends up giving up 7. They lose 7-2 or something like that. And he comes into the dressing room, and sure enough, there's Billy Smith, and he's like, that's the performance. That's what I'm looking for in a goalie right there. You made me proud tonight. So that's what the book is full of, is stuff like that.
That's awesome. Well, we can't wait till that comes out, James. We appreciate you coming on the podcast, telling us some good golf stories, and hopefully you can get outside at some point playing golf like the rest of us. So you're not breaking any more lamps on your deck.
Thank you. I had one idea. So this has been bugging me in my head all weekend, and I was talking to a few golf guys about it. So obviously we all want golf to come back, but we do know that it's a delicate issue to talk about because you look selfish and elitist, and the thing that people criticize about golf is that it's a sport, and which I think is sometimes unfair. There's a lot of great junior programs and programs for people that don't have access, but usually you have to have a little bit of money to play golf. And so people are quick to criticize when any golfer says, hey, let's have golf come back. But at the same time, I think we all agree, and you guys have probably talked about it on here, that golf can be a fairly safe activity with some modifications that they have made. And people could play golf fairly safely, and it would be good for the businesses. But so I was figuring, why don't we, this would probably be logistically impossible, so it's kind of pie in the sky stuff. But if everybody has to pay, say, $10, like a tax that would go straight to, I'm working with an organization called Conquer COVID-19, Haley Wickenheiser and Ryan Reynolds, or some other fundraiser that went to the needs that we have in COVID. You imagine if everybody had to pay $10 for every round they play. First of all, I would think 90% of the golfers would do it. $10 a round, we're so desperate to get out there. You could raise so much money in such a short period of time. And I think it would somewhat change the perception as golf as, oh, all you guys care about is playing golf right now when all this other stuff is going on in the world. So if anybody's smart enough to figure out how to do it, that's my suggestion. $5 or $10 tax on every round that goes to a donation to some COVID organization.
That's awesome. That sounds like a great idea. And hey, maybe we get some people to pursue it.
Well, that's that was me on my high horse today.
Well, we appreciate it.
And golfers finally look like heroes.
It's true. You know, we talk about it, you know, golf as being so important. You know, I like this idea. We all want golf to come back. We realize it's not essential, but we realize it can be done safely. So hopefully it does come back when the time it does come. And even if it's open, why not still add a little bit of a tax just to give back to these great charities?
Absolutely. And by the way, have you guys had the debate about whether if you hit the raised cup on a tee shot, whether that would be count as a hole in one?
I've had it a few times on Twitter, but we haven't had it on the podcast yet. I don't think we have enough hours on the podcast to debate it, but I would say no. That's my take.
Now, James, do you have a hole in one?
Oh,
I do not have a hole in one. It's another thing that haunts me forever.
That might change your answer then.
I feel like it's coming. No, but it would really bother me if you hit a shot that you could tell was going perfectly in. You know what I mean? If it had that perfect speed and was going center cup, but I just don't think you could count it. It's painful, but you can't, because people are trying to count them.
No. What would you like if you got one? Would you have to put it on a plaque, the ball, and then get the cup too?
Get the raised cup.
The raised cup.
But at least have to be in the photo.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't even have the video everybody takes of them picking up the cup, the ball, and then showing it. The ball would be lying 3 feet away. It would just be weird.
You got a point there. Well, James, we'll let you get. I know you got work to do today. Like some of us are lucky enough to still be working out here. So we really do appreciate your time, and you're welcome back anytime.
True pleasure, guys. Thank you so much for having me. Always talk for as long as you want to guys who love the game as much as I do. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, James, for that great interview. We really appreciate it. We love your idea. We love your idea of what golf courses can be doing and giving back to the charities that are looking to fight this virus. And the one he did mention is conquercovid19.ca. They're creating t-shirts that literally say conquer COVID-19. 100% of the proceeds go towards fighting off this virus. I know I ordered a shirt right after. Scotty's got his shirt on his way, and we highly, highly recommend all of you take some time. If you have some extra cash, I know cash is tight right now, but if you do have the money to donate, check it out. Worth every penny. I promise you that. Thank you, James.
But yeah, James is great. I mean, one of the things that is consistent about him all the time is that he uses his public platform to give back, whether it's to people, to charities, whatever the case may be. So, a lot of people admire him for what he does on TSN, the work that he does, the position that he's in with hockey, obviously loves golf as well, but the fact that he continues to give back and use his platform to do that, you know, kudos to him.
Great guy. Loved it. Why don't we talk about some other things we got going on? I came across this video on YouTube, and it was the Shell Wonderful World of Golf, which we've talked about a couple times on here, a couple different events. But this one was from 1963. And we had a young Jack Nicklaus, 23 years old, facing elder, Sam Snead.
Careful.
Because he's only 51, but facing Sam Snead at Pebble Beach.
Yeah.
Boy, it's only 45 minutes. Check it out. If you look up, I believe just type in literally Shell World of Golf Nicklaus, you can find it. 45 minutes on there. Pebble Beach, it's worth watching. There's nobody doing cartwheels in the sand traps or any nonsense that you see at the AT&T that I hate. But what an awesome 45 minutes. Highly, highly recommend. And we're just going to chat a little bit about it.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the cool things about this one, I've watched lots of these. There's over 100, I think 114, something like that, of Shell's Wonderful World of Golf, the various series, because they had two different periods when they had them. And I've written stories about them, pointed to them online and stuff over the years. But the cool thing about this one is that it's one of the earlier ones. It was digitally remastered. So one of the things that you see in some of the earlier ones is that, you know, the color's poor, the film is poor, but they've done a lot of work on this. I guess the PGA Tour did the work. And, you know, the color is amazing. It's really a neat look, you know, through a looking glass at Pebble Beach of how it looked almost 60 years ago and how different it looked. And obviously with two of the best players of all time playing it, you know, it made for certain nuances there as well in not only what they were like, but, you know, what the spectators were like, shots that they hit, how the course played. So, yeah, it was definitely some compelling stuff.
I agree with you 100%. For me, this actually sold me on paying $800 to play Pebble Beach.
Really?
I, on this podcast, have said $800 is ridiculous. And watching this, if given the chance, I will pay it. I've decided I will pay the money.
You know you won't get to play with Jack Nicklaus and Sam Snead, right?
I do. But I think it's just the history there. I actually think it looks better now, or back then, sorry.
Back then, yeah.
I loved how it wasn't perfect. I think you and I are very, you know, we're beating that drum many times about golf doesn't need to be perfect and the course doesn't need to be perfect. The edges of the bunkers weren't perfect. There was one, I believe it was on 17, actually, where Jack's not really in the bunker. He's on the edge of it, but they don't really cut the edges that well. So it's still a sand shot, but he's on top of grass. Oh, so cool. And then like everything like that. And did I know there was an old fifth hole that was just this awful par three? What an, like Jack said, it was the worst hole. It's an awful hole. I had no idea, because that hole is amazing now, that long, long par three that it is today. But it was cool. One of very cool experience.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people in going back and seeing it, it really gives you the feel of the fact that it's a public golf course, you know, and it's a resort course now. But, you know, the conditions, it wasn't pristine. It wasn't Augusta National. And you got to remember, we talked about that even going back and watching older, you know, the Masters films. The course wasn't the same there as well. And you didn't see people complaining or, you know, worried about it. I mean, we saw hard pan areas. There was, I mean, really what was neat about it was I liked the fact that they had a lot of aerial footage. They obviously used a plane,
a drone. Shot
some, yeah, I don't think they had a drone, and shot some aerial footage. And really outside of the fairways and the greens, it was brown, it was hard pan, it was bare.
There was even some fairways, though, like Jack even talks about it. I forget the hole, but Sam laid up on a par four because he couldn't get there. And he's like, that area was just kind of natural grass. It wasn't like fairway grass, and you could see it, and it was like sitting on top of the grass and it was like thick, and the rough was thick, and the greens were slow, and it was cool. Like I think we've made golf too pretty.
Yeah, I think just the standard of asking for perfection, of going over and over again and expecting it to be, you know, high definition. You know what I mean? I mean, when you see it on TV and you're looking at it in 4K, you know, things have to look sort of perfect. And that sort of tends to be the expectation for a lot of golfers. They go out there and they expect things to be perfect. They want all these greens to be, you know, 12 every day. You know, and it's just not realistic. I mean, it's grass.
What do you think
it's
they were?
It's a living material. I would say they were running maybe about 7.5 to 8.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, bumpy.
Yeah. Yeah, bumpy. Obviously, the POA kind of takes in there. And I laughed because some of the first putts that we saw, I mean, Nicklaus just smashed the putts. And I mean, that was the downhill putts. He had a downhill putt early on that I'm looking at it and going, man, that looks like a tricky putt. You know, you can see the slope and you know what some of those greens are like. They're really tiny and they still are there. But all of a sudden, he's got this downhill putt that I'm thinking, man, right now he'd probably hit this 15-footer. He'd hit it like 2 feet, and it would just trickle down to the hole. He rammed this thing like it was a 40-footer uphill, and it barely got to the hole.
Yeah, and it just like stops.
Yeah.
It was so weird. There was a couple other, like Jack's bunker shot on 7. And I've seen this. It's weird that I've seen this clip a bunch. I don't know why, but where he's in that bunker back and they had the guy walking. I think it was Gene Sarazen was walking around for most of the part, which Gene just sounds like every guy that's ever been on the radio back in like the 30s, you know what I mean? Like that iconic voice that you would represent. That's exactly how Gene sounded. But he went up to Sam and, you know, what do you see there? He's like, oh, he's either dead or it'll be 15 feet past, which I think now today, if you're in that spot and the pin is where it is, you're probably 30 feet past based on how fast the greens would be.
And how firm they are.
Yeah. And Jack hit it to like 5 feet, made the putt, and it's just devastating. Like that up and down saved him to end up obviously winning in the end. Oh, maybe we spoiled it. Maybe I'll throw a spoiler in there. Doesn't matter. It was in 1963. Yeah. If anyone watched it now, too bad. The other thing, there was some cool, funny slogans that came out of it. The one on when Jack hit that bunker shot on 17, that bunker fescue-y shot, the commentator said he hit a honey, and I had no idea if he bladed it over the green or if he hit it close. Turns out he hit it like right beside the pin and ended up making that putt.
Yeah.
But what is that, a saying that was around for a long time?
It was. That's a generational thing before me. But you know, the other thing about it was the fact that, you know, this one's a little bit different than the other Shells films that they show. A lot of the Shells films that they show, they just play the film. This one basically had a retrospective because it was Jack Nicklaus looking at it. So even he was admitting, he's like, oh man, if I had that putt today, you know, it wouldn't stop. Or, mm-hmm. you know, if I had that chip, there's no way, or I couldn't stop the ball. So he was admitting the conditions, saying, you know, those greens were soft then. They're not like they are nowadays. So he was really telling it how it was, that, you know, he wasn't painting this rosy picture that, oh, golf was harder or whatever the case may be. They had different tools. They obviously, you know, they're obviously had persimmon woods, golf balls didn't fly quite as straight or whatever, but he also admitted the golf course was a lot easier to play. And in the end, you know, you've spoiled a little bit, it wasn't like they shot, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 under par.
No, even par picked up a win with a big putt on 18 to make it happen.
Yeah, exactly.
For $1,000.
Yeah, he got the $1,000 extra. It was $3,000 for Snead, Snead for first, and $2,000 for second for Jack.
Yeah.
Or is that opposite?
Opposite, sorry.
Yeah, opposite. All right, yeah. See? I forgot already who
exactly.
won.
Exactly. The one thing that I think I said off top that I would now pay this price, this ridiculous price to pay it. And I was shocked when Jack said this. He actually said if he only could play one course, it would be Pebble.
Yeah.
And Jack has designed 270 golf courses. You think maybe he would have picked one of his own. No, you maybe think Augusta. No. Pebble Beach is what he said.
Yeah, and I think part of that too, though, is I think that's his emotional tie based on his own memories of having success there as well.
That's fair.
I don't think it's just about the design itself, which obviously it's iconic and the views are amazing and things like that. I think for him, you know, his body of work there in winning the Pebble Beach tournaments, winning a U.S. Amateur there, winning a U.S. Open there, he's had so many of those moments in his life. I think that is what his connection is to it. Just like when we talk about favorite golf courses, sometimes it's not about the design. It's about the memories that we have there. And, you know, we can go back and talk about a golf course that you played with three buddies back in the day, and you would probably rank that higher based on the experience over the golf course.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Either way, cool watch.
Yeah.
Go check it out. It's 45 minutes. Gives you something to do. Not like you're probably playing golf today. But what this allowed us to do is it made us, there's a couple cool putters they were obviously using because back in 1963, and it made us think, you know, last week we did our top five TaylorMade irons of all time, and I may have gotten into looking into some of those old TP sets. I'm trying to pull some strings. Hopefully I can get my hands on a set of those.
You're going down the rabbit hole now.
Probably.
Just get ready to throw some money.
Yeah. Either way. But we decided, you know, those putters were cool. Let's do our top five putters of all time. So not just, you know, these are just for us, you know, favorites, whether there's a reasoning behind it or not. And doesn't need to be one specific brand. But if we're going all time, we're going all time. So why don't we get that started? And I'm going to give you the first one.
Well, I think there was a few of them that were sort of a common theme for us as we looked at each other's lists. And that sort of made it interesting. I think for me, you know, the Ping Answer, obviously iconic putter, came out in 66, but the 3 model was the one that was I liked. The regular Answer didn't have any alignment guides. The 3 was a slightly larger head, had an alignment line that was on it, and it was one of the ones that early on for me I coveted. I wanted to get a hold of, and I played one for several years. And you know, again, it's one of the most copied designs of all time. And I think if anybody comes up with a list of all-time putters, it's got to be one of them.
Yeah, it should be number one. on all of them. The Ping Scottsdale answer was my Ooh. Answer.
Yeah.
and I just kind of wrote down, like, it was the first to do it. And I think if Ping made royalties off every other brand that copied this design, they would never have to make a golf club again. I don't know how, maybe they do, maybe they don't. I really don't know how that works, but it's one that everyone has one. I have three different brands with the exact same design, and it's one of my favorites. And a lot of people, you know, they're like, how is Scotty Cameron not number one? Well, Scotty Cameron came after the Ping design, and yes, he made great answer style models, and we probably will get to those as we go along. But that was that had to be number one on my list as well. So let's hit it. Number two.
All right. This is where I sort of start digging into some other models. Probably one you didn't really, look at too fondly because it just didn't fall into your era. But the Ram Zebra mallet was kind of, for me, it was one of the first mallets that I ever played. It had its run for a while. Guys like Tom Watson were big on it, which again was before you played. But the neat part about the Zebra as well is that, you know, they eventually came up with a model where you could remove the sole plate and then you could change the amount of weighting underneath, which was something early on you just didn't see. And I've got personal ties to this one too, because, I had some of my best rounds ever with the Zebra putter. Although when I go back and I went and I bought another one years after I played it, it didn't really match up to what I maybe thought in my mind.
Yeah.
Maybe my memories of it were a little too fond, but definitely one of the top putters of all time.
It's not the most attractive putter I've seen. That's a good way to put it. That much. You've probably seen, if anyone's worked in the golf industry, you've seen a bunch of these traded in over the years and probably never thought twice about him. Pretty funny though. I'm actually looking up on Google right now, and there's a full Golf WRX thread with like 40 plus posts of if this putter was before its time. And I'm going to say no, it fits its time perfectly. I'm going to go to a putter that probably is going to age the exact same way. And it's just one that it's one of the only mallets that I've ever really kept in the bag, and that's the TaylorMade Spider that I have in right now. And it's been
modern classic. Yeah,
it's kind of a modern classic that we probably will look back on, you know, 20 years from now and be like, yeah, it's kind of ugly, maybe. Like, but it's just one that I've always loved. I actually had one of the earlier designs of it. Was one of my first putters that was a non-answer design putter, and it was much bigger. I love the new design of it. It's a little bit smaller, a little bit more compact, and I like the colorway a little bit better with the gold and the blue that they've been doing recently. And you actually can get any colorway if you go to TaylorMade.ca. But yeah, as I said, it's currently in the bag. It's the first putter that I ever used that took out that non-answer design. And, you know, I have I'll get to another one later that clearly I go back and forth with, but just, I enjoy it. It's something different. If my stroke's not working with the blade style, I go to this, and I do think it is more of, it is a classic. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for it's one of those putters that really the pyramid of influence really had a lot of effect on it. You know, it came out, when it first came out, people are like, yeah, it's a mallet, but it kind of looks a little different. But, you know, once it started to get some momentum on tour, you know, players were flocking to it, and obviously it gained a lot of momentum on tour. And as a result of it, then consumers started going after as well and saw the benefits from it. And obviously, you know, TaylorMade has made it a franchise for them. And as you mentioned, you know, become a putter that, you know, you can get customized as far as color and look and lots of features. And as a result of it, you're right, there are probably going to be a lot of them around for a long time.
And the thing is, like with other clubs, like the putter is one that if they're using it on tour, it's working, right? Yeah. And a lot of players' contracts do not include a putter. It's one of those ones where they demand the wiggle room because the putter is that most important club in the bag. So if a lot of players are using it, they're probably not being paid to. That's just the best thing for them. So just something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the for players, I mean, that putter is so important. You're right. A lot of 13 club deals use whatever putter that they will have success with. For some players, that's a lot. That's a putter that, you know, they go through a lot of putters. Maybe a guy like Brad Faxon might go through like three in his whole career. It really varies. So I'm going to throw in another one here. You mentioned Scotty Cameron early on when Scotty Cameron was starting to get some commercial success. So this is after he was doing designs for Mizuno, some other companies as well. The Scotty Cameron Catalina, which is one of the early classics models, one of the early ones in his partnership with Titleist. Very traditional, almost an answer style head, but it also had a large amount of offset with a curved shaft, fairly large, like I said, offset. Didn't really have a hosel, which was kind of interesting. It's sort of the shaft went right into the head. And as a result of it, it was a putter that I really liked the look of. I liked the feel of. I should have kept.
That was my first question. Do you still have one?
One of those ones that, I had in my bag for a couple years. And then, you just don't even think about it. You just sort of go, onto your next putter or whatever. And then it's usually 3 or 4 years later that you start to have that regret and go, man, I should have just kept that putter.
We all have a couple of those. Yeah, that's a cool one. Definitely look that up. If you're a Scotty Cameron or Titleist putter guy, just look it up and you'll recognize the look. It is different, seeing a blade putter without, without a hosel is I didn't pick up on it at first, and there are some models later that they kind of try to do it with the hosel, but I think the true one definitely has it without the hosel. Cool pick. I like that. I went with the Titleist Bullseye for my next one.
Another classic.
Absolute classic design. It's one of those, I can use it left-handed or right-handed putters.
when necessary.
Exactly. It was actually... we had a little putting game at our wedding, and we had a Titleist Bullseye as the putter for that. And the reason why is I found that putter in a dumpster. So we used to get trade-ins at the golf shop I worked at for a couple of them, they wouldn't be worth anything. And this was one that people, they didn't clean off the bottom. They had no idea. And I guess somebody gave it away for $1. And I found it in the dumpster. I'm taking it home. I cleaned it up. It's in horrible shape, but it's just so cool to have a bullseye. You'd be crazy to use one nowadays just because it's really hard to square up the face of something that's like as wide as a piece of paper. But man, it's a classic that if you go back to any tournament, back to the 60s or whatever, there's probably 10 guys using a design similar to this.
Yeah, I mean, Scotty Cameron ended up coming out with a remake of it later on where they made a larger size version of it, which, had a higher MOI, a little easier to use. But if you look back, John Reuters was the original designer for Bullseye, and it was just a brass two-way putter. But they started making other models of it. And one of the ones that I liked, and, Bullseye was a favorite for me here too, but a specific one. I liked the one that had a little bit of offset and a little bit of a flange to it on the back, which is a little bit different. Now, I paid a little bit more than you did for yours, but not by much. I actually was playing with a gentleman who's now he was an RCMP at the time, and now he's been a general manager of golf courses for probably going 25 years now. And I played with him one day, and he had this bullseye with a flange on an offset. I played around with it, really liked it. He was beginning to hate it at that point. So I'm thinking, here's a great opportunity. I got it for 2 sleeves of Titleist DT90 golf balls. So probably cost me $15, maybe tops or whatever, and exchanged that for it. And unfortunately, I didn't keep that one either. Oh. This is a bad, bad habit of mine. I did keep some putters over the years, but the Bullseye for me, not the two-way model, but the model with the flange, a little bit offset, was another one that was on my list.
I like it. My fourth one is the Wilson 8802. That's that little tiny blade putter, actually in the 1963 Shell World of Golf. It looks like Jack had one very similar to that kind of design. And it's, Crenshaw used it, Mickelson used it. It's got that kind of heel toe design. You can basically go at any point in history and find somebody using this. And it's such a cool putter. And I recently got my hands on one again. I was playing around a golf with a rep of Wilson, and this wasn't, I didn't know him. We just got paired up and I saw this in his son's bag and he wasn't using it. And I said, how much do you want for that? And, ended up sending this guy, an e-transfer right then and there on the golf course. And
wow,
it's been in my home ever since. It's not in the best shape, but I kind of like it that way. It's a little beat up. It looks older, just a great design. It's not the easiest to putt with either, not the most forgiving, you could say, but I love the design. And if you've ever watched Mickelson putt over the years, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it was definitely, for me, iconic as well. They had an 88-13, which came later, which is sort of the same style or whatever. A lot of putters that looked like that in those days. Ram had a Wizard putter as well that was like that. And I think there's the white one that Jack Nicklaus used was, I think, a Ram. I'm almost sure of it as far as White Fang is what he called it. But yeah, 8802 was definitely on my list. You know, especially had this fluted shaft in the putter, and it was designed really for that soft stroke. And Ben Crenshaw, for me, you know, iconic player, loved to watch him play. I loved his style of play. And I think I told that story on this podcast before of being early on at the PGA show, one of my first ones that I ever went to. And they used to have all these classic booths that were there. People would sell, you know, different types of older blades and all sorts of things. You'd go to the booth and you could actually buy it. We haven't seen as many of those at the PGA show over the years, but I might have been 21 or 22, wandered into this one booth, and I'm sitting there looking at the 8802s and the 8813 putters and looking through, and lo and behold, it was Ben Crenshaw was standing right next to me doing the exact same thing. And he actually ended up educating me on the flex of the shaft, and he was looking for a particular shaft that was in these to get a particular feel because he wanted something that was a little bit softer than normal to work with the flow of his stroke. So yeah, iconic putter. I could not include it in my list, even though you were including it as well.
Exactly. And you talk about this 8813. I actually have kind of a ping model that's kind of like the 8813. It's a little bit bigger than the 8802. It's a cool design. Another one where it just kind of, I think somebody traded it in that was worth $2, something like that. And I took it home.
Good deal.
My last one's the Scotty Cameron Newport 2. I think everyone's had one at some point. Everyone knows it from the Tiger Woods putter that he's had in his bag ever, forever. You know, Ping did it first. Everyone should recognize who did it first and who designed it. I think Scotty Cameron changed the way we look at putters in a lot of ways. And I think the Newport too. What else can I say about it? It's a beautiful putter. It goes in and out of the bag with that spider right now, but it's the one, you know, I know the spider might be one of those ones that I look back on in 20 years and be like, I wish I never sold that. This is one that's this one's never going anywhere.
Hang on to those putters. Now, we talked about, you know, all the putters that we do love, but there's also a lot of putters that were some of the most popular of all time and weren't necessarily ones that we loved. Did you have a particular one that, you know, fell into that category for you?
Yeah. I despise, will never use it, can't putt with it, don't like the look of it, just hate it. I apologize to the brand. It's nothing against the brand. They make great putters. Great putters. Yeah. This is not one of them for me. The Odyssey 2 ball. I think it's hideous. I personally like the minimal amount of alignment possible on a putter, which is crazy because I said I've been using a TaylorMade spider a lot. But I get why it was made. It's visually it makes sense, but I just do not like it. I don't like the feel of it. No. Never. No. You'll never see one of those near me.
Well, you know what? I used I had one of the early Rossi models from Odyssey, and I loved the Stronomic insert that they used. That's what they called it. It was a firmer. It was a black insert that was in it, and I really liked the feel of that. In fact, I think one of the early Rossi 2s from Odyssey, I think my wife still has it in her bag, but I think for me, I didn't mind the 2-ball from a visual standpoint. It was the white hot insert for me. So all the putters that had the white hot insert, it was just too soft for me. And I think that was always an issue. I always played a soft golf ball. When, you know, you try to pick between models within a company, I don't usually go for a slightly softer one. So I think that hurt me a little bit when I would pick out any of the putters. So for an example, any of the, you know, maybe the white hot
in the two ball model, I wouldn't like, just because of the softness of the face. So despite the fact it was one of the greatest selling putters of all time, models continue to be one of the best putters of all time. And Odyssey obviously does a great job with that. But yeah, I'm kind of in that camp. But for me, it's particularly because of the insert just being too soft.
That is fair. See, we're not biased here. We're just giving our opinions. That's all that matters.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't worry about it. They're still great putters. One of my best buddies, John, he has it. Guy can't putt at all, but he likes his two putt. So, I mean, his two ball. It could be called two putt because he always two putts with it. He never makes anything. That's it for the top five putters. A little trip down memory lane there as well with the shell world of golf. Let's grab a quick break. We'll come back with the mailbag and the tip of the week.
This episode of Tee Talk is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new Sim Fairway. After months of obsessive testing and tinkering, the TaylorMade engineers cracked the code with the newly redesigned V-Steel sole, which allowed them to take the center of gravity lower than any fairway they've ever created. The result is a huge benefit, whether you're an amateur or a top 10 world-ranked golfer. It's now much easier to get high launch from anywhere on the course. The all-new Sim and Sim Max Fairways. They took CG lower to take you higher. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family.
All right, Scotty, the mailbag is back. You opened it up. A lot of good questions this week. This is one of my favorite times of the week because it means that people actually want to hear what we think, which
doesn't always happen at your house.
No, it doesn't happen at my house, at work. You know, the first half of the podcast, right? It's like, just give me the interview. I don't care what Stefan thinks. So, but now the questions are coming and they know I'm going to answer them. So this is my favorite part. So Scotty, why don't you open up, give us these questions?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I think people are looking to be a little bit more entertained in their lives these days. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world right now. So you know what? If we act as an outlet for them to ask some of their interesting questions, because there's some in here this week. Anyways, we'll get to it. But let's start off with, do you think more people will choose to be a member at one course this year rather than travel to play due to the COVID-19 pandemic? That's an interesting one, actually.
It's a good question, too. And it's a good thought process. And I actually, come to think about it, I do. I think people will want to be safe. They'll probably recommend this, which is probably, you know, a lot of golf courses are hoping for that, you know, getting people consistently there, and you can kind of control the group hopefully a little bit. I actually do. And I'm thinking about myself. I probably will mostly play at my golf course now that I think about it, just because, you know, the conditions, you know, where things are, you'll know where, you know, the bathroom is and the process and if it's clean and all that stuff and where, you know, sanitizer is. I think, you know, I really do. I think that's a great question, a good thought from whoever sent that in.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, like you said, you'll be familiar with whatever the operating procedures are for that facility. You know, as much as we'd like to travel around and, you know, get, you know, use our money to spread it around and to help as many people as possible, I think this is a situation that will probably take place. We might see people just, you know, taking up memberships, a little less traveling around, but that doesn't mean they're not going to, you know, golf as much. That just means they may golf more in one place. And if everybody does that, then fine, we'll net out you know, to the same number of rounds anyways. But I agree. I think this will be something we'll see happen. People will just choose to go with something that's more familiar and easy. And then they don't have to worry about going to another place and finding out what their procedures are and then going through that possibility. They'll know how to deal with things at their own course and just
Golf course can be confusing enough if you've never been there. It's like, okay, where's the pro shop? Where do I
pay? It's a good topic.
Yeah, I mean, it can be a little confusing at times. So with this being involved, like, maybe am I even allowed in here? So I think it's a good thought, and maybe we'll talk more with some golf courses over the next couple of weeks and see what their thoughts are around
that. It's an interesting topic, actually, and you know, we maybe can explore that later, like you said, on the fact that as far as golfers going to a golf course and knowing where to go. And I know for a fact over the years I've had golf lessons where people said, you know what,
what happens when I get to a golf course? Where do I go? How do I go? So it's really important for golf courses to think about that. If someone new is coming to their golf course, of where's their signage, where's the, all the guidance that they need if they've never been there before. So, all right, on to a next one here. Looking to do a golf tour of Scotland, but want to play some courses that are less known. Any suggestions? Now, a lot of people, obviously, if they do travel, they're going to make a one-time trip over to the UK. They usually look up every golf course that's hosted the Open Championship and go, I want to play there, if they have the resources to do it. But I will tell you, there are hundreds of golf courses in Scotland and plenty that are worth playing. So do you have any suggestions, or you didn't play too much when you're over there?
Yeah, I haven't played when I'm over there, but for me, I get what you're doing. You're probably trying to save a little bit of money, I respect that 100%. Just do yourself a favor. Just play St. Andrews if you can. Even if it's one of the other courses there, just play around there. Have dinner there, spend an afternoon there, walk through the town. You walk anywhere in the town. You just have to go to St. Andrews. If you're going that far, if you're coming from Canada, North America, and this is a once-in-a-lifetime trip, then at least play one once-in-a-lifetime course. You don't need to play all the open courses. Mm-hmm. Again, like a lot of these golf courses really are built for, the fact that they're just good to host a lot of people. They're not the best courses over there, but St. Andrews is the home of golf. Go play it. Outside of these kind of other, less known courses, this is why Scott goes on these trips, so he can answer this question. So I'll give it to Scott.
Yeah, I'd say right on that same vein. If you get to St. Andrews and you don't happen to have time to play, try to time it so you're there on a Sunday. The old course is closed that day. You can walk around. You can walk the whole property. The first time I went there, I walked from the first tee all the way through to the 18th. That's a great way to see it that way. But really, if you look at it in different neighborhoods, let's say St. Andrews, for an example, like you said, you could play one of the lesser courses, play the Eden or Stratham or Jubilee. You can go down the road and play at Crail. Just in Fife as well, there's small ones like London Links or Leven Links that are there. If you head up the coast towards Aberdeen, you may play something like Fraserburgh. There's a lot of smaller courses that are not quite as known that you can play down in the Gullan area, East Lothian, which most people will know for like Muirfield or North Berwick. The Glen Club is down there, Kilspindy. There's, I could ream off tons. So if this listener is hearing this and they want to know more, just DM me back again. Let me know exactly where you're going and I'll find you some smaller layouts to play, something that maybe you can join. There's overseas memberships available as well that, maybe you're going to make a golf course your home base or a town your home base, and that you could possibly join there as an overseas member and play for a week while you're there for less than, maybe a few green fees. All right, next one here. Obviously, somebody's getting ready for spring, wondering, what the weather is going to be like, hopefully if this snow stops and the fact they can get out there. But they want to know what manufacturers make waterproof golf bags, which, become more and more important if you're willing to golf in all sorts of conditions. I have lots of friends that will not play in tons of rain. For me, if I get to play, I get to play. But I'll just answer this one quickly. I know Sun Mountain, for an example, they've just come out with three new models in their H2NO collection. Titleist has a stay dry series of models. So there are a number of manufacturers that do come out with fully waterproof golf bags, which basically means, they've got waterproof main materials, seam sealed pockets, just all the little touches that are going to allow you to seal the bag up as much as possible and to keep water out of there.
100%. Said, just look around. I know Vessel makes one if you're looking for more
Stitch.
Of the...
Stitch. Stitch has got some new ones too.
Stitch. Yeah. If you're more looking for that kind of luxury line. But pretty much every brand does it. Just read the fine print, right? Some are water resistant, some are waterproof. And I do know, the couple that you listed off there are just, they advertise as waterproof. So I'm sure you're looking at different warranties and things along those lines.
Yeah, you're going to pay a little bit more for one of the waterproof models in general, just because of the different materials that has to be used, the other details. But, if you're wanting to be out there all the time, then, it's worth it. Just like a good rain suit is, just spend the money and you'll be fine that way. So, all right, a few more questions here. I've heard you both talk about caddying at a pro level. What do you think is the hardest part of the job?
Yeah, I thought about this for a while, and I'm going to sum it up. The fact that I thought about it for a while means there's so much to think about, and I think that's the hardest part, is that I'm just going to go you through my mindset like out there, and it starts as a little detail is like, how much more water is in his water bottle? Okay, let's get another water bottle. Okay, is that last water bottle I got, is that still cold enough? Okay, now I just put two of the warm ones out. Now I have three cold ones in there. Okay, does he need a snack? Okay, is he getting kind of grumpy right now? He might be hungry. Okay, do I just suggest this? Like, this is just the stuff, those little things. Like, oh, is it going to rain? How long have we been out here?
Way more than just carrying a bag.
Is it time for sunscreen, right? And then, do I have enough water to do the sunscreen? Because after I use the sunscreen, I got to wipe. It's all those little details are the hardest part. If it was literally just going up, and which is a very hard part, and the best caddies, this is where it really separates, because anybody can do the stuff that I just mentioned. The fact that I've been able to do it means anybody can do it. Of these little details, the best guys make their money on the decisions that make money, which makes you, that's a skill. I don't think that's the hardest part. That's a skill that you learn. The hardest part is just balancing all the minuscule details that go over every single day. You just have to be such a good time manager and just aware of little things of your guy or gal that you're caddying for. It's not an easy job. They're paid very well at the high levels because they deserve it. And the best ones stick around for a long time because they're able to balance that hard part of balancing all the little things plus making the right decisions.
Yeah, it's that organization and anticipation. I mean, it's like you said, it's having things figured out before they happen, because you know what? As much as a round of golf takes a fairly long period of time, when you're out there, a lot of the decisions, a lot of things that have to happen in a quick time frame. So if you're not organized and thinking ahead of what needs to be done, then you're going to be behind. You're going to get flustered. So the best caddies are organizing themselves. They know what to anticipate. Just as you said, you know what the player is going to be asking for or looking for or wanting. You know where you need to be. You know where they're going to move. You know how they want their club handed to them, what they want to hear from you. Some of them want to hear certain things. Some of them don't want to hear other things, you know, whether that's positive affirmations, whether that's certain information. So I think that organization is the big thing. I think the one thing that a lot of people don't really think about, though, is the time. And that is the hard part. You're not just a caddy there for 4.5 or 5 hours. Generally, you are there the whole week. It takes a lot of effort. You are there sun up, sundown. Practice times, warm-up times, waiting by the locker room for your player. If there's a rain delay, that's some of the worst. I've had rain delays. I can remember a Canadian Tour event. I think you probably caddied in that one. The one at Loyalist where there was a rain delay, I think, for probably 6 or 7 hours because there was one part of the fairway on one hole that wouldn't dry up, and they were afraid golf balls were going to plug there. So you're just sitting there, and it's hurry up and wait. And you have to be ready to be back on the range and with your player immediately, as soon as they want you. So it's a case of the hard part is it's really long days. It's not standard hours, and you've always got to be ready to help your player out.
Yeah. You got to know everything. Like there's, I'm just thinking of all these different random details. And I think one of the things, and I've caught myself doing like second guessing, like random rules in the rule book you never even think about. I remember one moment, I couldn't get this piece of dirt out of a wedge, and I'm just scrubbing with the towel. And I was like, oh, we got a brush here. And I literally turned to the guy right before I used it. And I said, am I allowed to use this?
Yeah.
Cause like, it's like, I'm glad I asked and you are allowed to use it, but it's just like, there's random rules like that you don't think about it. And that's the other thing, is now knowing the rules, even though you don't need to, but there's certain things that can get you in trouble. So it's hard. There's a lot to know, and don't do what I did and start at the top level, as fun as that sounds. Start at the lower levels and learn the hard parts, and you'll get there if this is a career you want to go. And if it is, let Scott and I know, and we'll get you in touch with the right people.
Yeah, there you go. So, all right, a funny one here. I don't even know what the context is, but the question is, sweet garlic, smoky barbecue, or blazing hot?
Interesting. So I assume they're talking about wings. I'm going to go with the wings.
I would
wings.
Assume so. I mean, yeah,
and they're
let's
going,
go with wings.
See, there's the thing. They're not allowing you, like, middle grounds here.
No,
all
there's
very
no options
different.
Here.
They're all very different. So I'm going to start with, I'm eliminating sweet garlic. When I think of wings, I don't think of sweetness. I think of some sort of spice. Now, I'm between smoky barbecue and blazing hot. Now, I like spicy food. I don't like to ruin my food. I like that buffalo. Like, when I think wings, I think buffalo wings, like spicy.
Yeah.
Smoky barbecue's okay. That's the thing. Like, can I get through the blazing hot? Am I actually going to enjoy it? So I'm going to go with the smoky barbecue on this one. I don't want to be dying when I'm eating my food.
Yeah, I think this is part of the reason why when you go to some of the iconic wing places now, they have like 15 options instead of three.
Yeah.
So there is some middle ground or whatever. You know what? I'm a sweet garlic kind of guy. I'm a honey garlic kind of guy. I don't mind some hot stuff as well. Smoky barbecue would be fine too for me. Blazing hot, you know what? I don't want to eat just one wing and go throw up. That's just not cool for me. When we used to go down to the PGA show, we used to do a thing with some of our staff. We'd take them over to Buffalo Wild Wings and have them do their blazing hot wings that they had there, and they had to eat six. That was kind of their initiation to go to the show. And you know what? Realistically, those wings are not even hot now compared to some of the things that are out there. I don't know if you watched a show like Hot Ones on YouTube, and you see the level that some of these hot sauces that are at now. But I'll go sweet garlic. I know it sounds wimpy, but I like the flavor, and yeah, you can still eat a bunch of wings. I'm not there to I'm not there to impress my friends and eat one wing. I'm there to have a meal.
That's fair.
All right, last one here. What do you feel are the elements that make a par five hole a good design? Now, this could go into many, many, many things, but maybe a couple items, a couple things that you would look for that when you get done a par five, you go, oh, that was a good hole.
Yeah, for me, placement on every shot. So if you're the drive, you have to be able to place it. If you don't place in the right spot, zero chance of going there in two. I think there's so many par fives that are just par fives because they're just long and they didn't know what to do with the piece of land. I can think of so many off the top of my head. A par five doesn't need to be long to be a good par five. It could just be about placement on every single shot. Mm-hmm. You could have to hit an iron off the tee and it could still be a good par five, just because of placement. So I just think placement every shot, including the layup, even like laying up to the wrong spot, you know, putting yourself in a bad spot where you have to carry a bunch of bunkers and pins always tucked back there. So for me, it's just all placement, certain length, obviously, to a point. Like, even if it's a 400 yard par five, like, yeah, you might be able to place it every single shot. It's still kind of silly. So it's but for me, if it's one word, it's just placement.
I'd agree. Strategy is important in the fact that too many par fives that you see, unfortunately, they become really it's a long par three. They really just kind of lay it out so that, you know, you've got to bash two shots down there and then play your third.
Yeah.
And your third is a shot. And really, it doesn't matter how you get there. You just got to get down to that same yardage or whatever. So I'm sort of on the same vein. I would say for me, one of the biggest elements is that third shot. And as far as how that green is configured, I've always been fortunate to be someone who hit the ball a decently long way. But I've also felt that a lot of the par fives, if you're going to force a player or ask them to try to go for it in two, that there should be some risk that's there, and they should have to hit a quality shot in there on that second shot. It shouldn't just be a big flat green where they can just bash away at it from 270 yards. So I would just basically, for me, like to see a really thoughtful, especially on the third shot. Maybe the green's a little bit smaller. Maybe they've got a specific angle that you've got to approach from. So even if you're going to play your second shot into it, you've got to make sure that you're coming from the right side of the hole in order that you're going to have a little bit more success that way. So similar to the vein that you have, as far as the placement, but real strategy, especially with that third. And I think, you know, we talked about Pebble Beach in here a little bit. You know, their greens average about 4,200 square feet, pretty tiny. And I think there's some good examples there of, you know, holes like their 18th where, you know, you've got to hit a good shot on two or on one. Sorry, your good first shot on 18, a good second shot on 18 to place it properly so that you can play a third in there. And the second, you know, if you're going to go for it, there's a high amount of risk that's there.
Yeah, for me, like, I'm not a long hitter by any means. I'm not getting up to a lot of par fives and two anyway. But for me, it gets boring when it's just like, okay, driver, okay, I either just hit 3-wood as far as I can to get a wedge in my hand, and then I hit a wedge on where, you know, I like the challenge of the layup, right? Like maybe it's like actually tempting you to go for it because the going for it seems easier than the layup.
Mm-hmm.
Par 5 should make you think, and that's basically what it comes down to.
Yeah, I think you need that little bit of, that strategy, as you mentioned, so that, as you're playing all those shots, you've got to really, use all your levels of skill. It's just not length. I mean, if you just make a court or a hole and just make it long, that doesn't really do it for me. And I don't think, even for players that are longer, it might be an advantage in a certain way, but they still want to hit a skilled shot in there.
Yeah, I can think of one par 5 close to us that's like about 600. I think at one point it was actually a par 6. That's how I can't even find words. That's how dumb this hole is.
691 yards. I know.
And it's just this big dog leg, and now it's shorter.
Yeah.
But still, for me, it's still like a driver, which my driver on average is around 275, 280, 3-wood. And the 3-wood's a very difficult 3-wood, but like I literally cannot hit anything else because the green is tiny. I have to go as far as I can. And then even at that point, where my landing area is, there's like a cart path that runs through that area.
No options.
And then I end up at like 160 if it's windy. And it's like, it's just such a, it's silly bad. And it's literally one of those holes that's just long for the sake of being long. And that is a bad par 5.
I agree 100%.
But that's the mailbag for the week. Thank you, everyone, for sending in questions. We really appreciate it. Why don't we hit up the tip of the week and wrap it up, Scotty?
All right. One last thing for you this week. I know a lot of you are working away at home in self-isolation, working away on your golf swings. And, this may seem technical, but it's not really. But it's really a recommendation to look at some things that you do differently and really seek your coach's knowledge in this. And one thing that happens a lot for a lot of people is that they're used to having two hands on the golf club. They make their golf swings, they set up, they put two hands on the golf club. They don't really think about the movements of their arms separately and how they work. So I really think a lot of people need to look at what I would call trail arm mechanics. So that's your arm that's away from the target side. And you want to see how it works independently and see how it's working, because it has a major effect on the face angle, has a major effect on how much club head speed that you can create, the size of your arc, a lot of different things. So very interesting for people if they just put their one right hand, if they're a right-handed golfer, on the club, start to work away, making backswings, understand how your arm works, how it folds, where it goes back and behind you, the angle that your wrists end up at. That trail arm mechanics, super, super important. Talk to your golf coach, see if that's an issue for you, and see if you can work on that.
I love it. Thank you, Scotty. I'll be outside today. It's
in the snow.
Nice. I got no snow out here right now, so maybe I'll go out and work on my trail arm. That's it for episode 62, folks. Thank you again to James Duthie for coming on the podcast. Make sure you check out conquercovid19.ca and see if there's anything you can do to help the cause. We're going to get golf soon. There's some announcements potentially coming out in Ontario. Hopefully we're opening up at some point when it is safe to do so. And the thoughts, and people are getting creative of how to open up safely. And I like that. So if you have any creative ideas, send them our way. We'll love to hear them. Or even just funny ideas of what we can do out on the golf course. I saw one idea recently where they brought the cups out, and if it hits the cup, but then it stays inside this 2-foot circle, this 3-foot circle, that counts as a made putt. So that could be fun. I don't know the true thoughts on that or if it makes sense, but hey, it's golf. It's somewhere out there, so I'm not too worried, but I'm not going to be too stickly. I know this for a fact. If you hit the cup on your tee shot, it's not a hole in one. We can agree on that.
We can 100%.
All right. Well, we will be back next week. I'm sure we'll have some more news. Everything's changing from week to week, and hopefully some positive news next week. But until then, everyone, stay safe, stay inside, and we'll see you next week. Like today, my boat's lost in the ocean.